From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we pay tribute to fake news. We'll hear from Stephen Colbert, who's crossing over into being a fake politician, declaring his intention to run for president. Also, we'll talk to Larry Wilmore, The Daily Show's senior black correspondent, and Ben Carlin, the former executive producer of The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. The objective truth about fake news coming up on Fresh Air. First, the real news.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of their Classics edition of The Essential Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, in stores and online at bn.com. From TIAA CREF, putting the heart of a nonprofit to work for the financial future of those who serve the greater good. That's powerof.org. And from Miramax Films, presenting The Hoax, starring Richard Gere, now available on DVD.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We know that many public radio listeners start the day with the news on Morning Edition and end the day with the fake news on The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. Today, we salute our colleagues on the fake side of journalism. The Daily Show with Jon Stewart just launched a new website with about 13,000 video clips spanning the show's history, giving us all a chance to catch up on moments we missed. Here's a clip from earlier this week when Jon Stewart commented on a recent speech by General Ricardo Sanchez, who commanded the coalition forces in Iraq from 2003 to 2004. In that speech, the general said, "We're facing a nightmare with no end in sight."
Sir, if your estimate was so dim so early on, why didn't you tell us this back then? Why didn't you tell us then?
The last thing that you want is for currently serving general officers to stand up against our political leadership.
Really? That's the last thing you want? Let's look at Sanchez's hierarchy of bad things. The worst thing ever, standing up to political leadership. And that's preferable to, what's the phrase?
A nightmare with no end in sight.
Look for more of these tremendous insights in Ricardo Sanchez's new book, I Have Difficulty Judging the Worstness of Things.
To find out what goes on behind the scenes at The Daily Show, I spoke with Ben Carlin. He joined the show as head writer in 1999, shortly after Jon Stewart became the anchor. Carlin became the executive producer and co-created The Colbert Report. He left both shows at the end of last year. When I spoke with him in April 2006, I asked him to describe the premise of Nate Cordry's Daily Show report on how Vice President Cheney shot his friend Harry Whittington in the face during a hunting trip.
It was really one of those things where, as more details came out, you kind of realized the story was a red herring, because what was most scandalous about the story, in our opinion, as we read reports, was not, you know, what happened between Cheney and Whittington, but actually the fact that the vice president goes on these particular kinds of hunts. The more details were revealed, kind of like deep into the stories as we were reading them, we're just like, wait a second, people go and shoot like 70 caged birds and they're right there and then they're just released. That's not hunting. And we just couldn't get our heads around like what, thinking about hunting as this, you know, pursuit which is involved with, has some skill, and you have to go out and you're in the brush all day and you know it's cold and you're up at the crack of dawn and all this ideas that you have about hunting. And we just kind of said, like, this here is really the scandal of this story, that this thing goes on, and is any way, this is the most furthest thing removed from hunting you can possibly imagine. So we said, like, let's actually try to do, this is the closest to, I think, actual journalism. We really go right up to that point. And so we tried to find a place that would let us come on and do one of these hunts.
Well, let's hear the opening of this piece, and then we'll talk more about how you put it together. So here's Nate Cordry on The Daily Show.
When the vice president went on a private hunting trip last month, he took a lot of heat for shooting his friend. But the truth is, he's actually a crack shot who's downed as many as 70 pheasant in a single day. And he's done it on canned hunts, where birds are raised to be shot. I wanted to hunt pheasant like the vice president, so I made a reservation at the Tobacco Stick Hunting Preserve in North Carolina.
We release birds per order of the customer, and the customer is able to go to the field and hunt for these birds.
It's like regular hunting, but with a menu.
Quail are $7 each.
Okay.
The chucker is $13 each. The pheasant is $16. And we use pointing dogs for $75 each.
Can I shoot the dog?
That'd be a very serious issue to shoot the dog.
So I can't shoot?
Can't shoot the dog.
I was pretty sure that the vice president would get to shoot the dog, but 140 pheasant would have to quench my bird lust. But would my $1,000 ensure this was better than regular hunting?
Well, here, the birds are in the field for you. You know they're there. It's a sure thing. The birds are here. On a wild bird hunt, you may find birds and you may not find birds.
And who really has time to hunt and track prey anymore?
It's a sure thing.
One thing I've always hated about hunting, it's a challenge.
So that's an excerpt from The Daily Show of a Nate Cordry report. My guest is Ben Carlin. He's an executive producer of the show, former head writer of the show, been with the show for 8 years. So Ben, explain a little bit more what goes on at this ranch and how the birds are actually shot by the people who've paid to hunt there.
I mean, they're basically kept in a coop, and you walk up and you look at what they have to offer in terms of the menu, and you pick out the amount of birds you want to shoot. And what they do is they take the birds in a crate and they put them in the back of a truck. They drive you and the birds in the back of the truck. So it's like this awkward, dead bird walking moment where you drive to the field. You're in the front seat. The birds are in the back. The guides, if you can call them that, will then take the crates, go out into the brush. They will then dump the bird upside down so it's disoriented into the thicket, okay? You will then get in position, and then the guide will nudge the bird, like roust it basically, and it will, being confused and disoriented, it will attempt to fly, and it flies up and you shoot it. So the one, nanosecond of freedom that this animal, experiences in its life is the nanosecond before it dies, and that's what the vice president does, we literally could not believe it. We sat there in the editing room and we could not believe that people do this, because truthfully, I went to school in Wisconsin. My roommate was a hunter. I very much like the idea. I don't hunt myself, but I like the idea of it's deer season and you go out. His dad was actually a bow hunter. And would go out every year and bag a couple deer, and I don't have any kind of ethical problem with that at all. This to me seems very cheating.
How did you get permission from this hunting ranch to shoot there? Did they know what you were really up to? Do they know the Daily Show?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think when you go and say we want to do a profile of your operation, you don't necessarily have to say, and oh, by the way, we're going to belittle it. We don't need to necessarily offer that kind of disclosure. We don't lie about what we're doing and who we are, but we also don't necessarily say, here is the jokes that we're going to tell at your expense. So it's kind of a balance, but we always are truthful to the degree that we don't deny, where we work and who we are and what we're doing.
But with the questions that Nate Cordry asked, they have to assume that either he's a satirist or he's learning disabled.
Yes. Yeah, but I got to tell you, more often than not, it's learning disabled. It's not, people don't, especially when you get into a world that is, fairly esoteric and not necessarily one that's drenched in a lot of exposure to the media or in a media center like New York. I don't think that there's necessarily that same skepticism that what's this person's angle necessarily. We do a fairly good job, better now than we used to, of trying as much as possible to put the onus of stupidity and creepiness on our people, mm-hmm. and not we don't want to make anyone look bad unless they're doing something really horrible. And in this case, these people that we were interviewing weren't, I wouldn't say the perpetrators, they were just people that were working there. So we just kind of used them to kind of get the information out and to kind of make some points in general.
I know another thing that you often do on The Daily Show is take clips from past interviews or past press conferences that completely contradict what that same person has just said and play them back to back. So you take a current clip of somebody in the news, often somebody in the Bush administration, and juxtapose that with a clip of them saying exactly the opposite thing weeks or months ago. And I'll play an example of that. And this is, I think this is called Bush versus Bush. And it's President Bush from the time when he was governor and campaigning for the presidency, juxtaposed with what President Bush has said about Iraq. So let's hear a short clip of this.
Mr. President, you won the coin toss. The first question will go to you. Why is the United States of America using its power to change governments in foreign countries?
We must stand up for our security and for the permanent rights and the hopes of mankind. The United States of America will make that stand.
Well, certainly that represents a bold new doctrine in foreign policy, Mr. President. Governor Bush, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I'm not so sure the role of the United States is to go around the world and say this is the way it's got to be.
All right, well, that's interesting. That's a difference of opinion, and certainly that's what this country is about. Differences of opinion. Mr. President, let me just get specific. Why are we in Iraq?
We will be changing the regime of Iraq for the good of the Iraqi people.
Governor, then I'd like to hear your response on that.
If we're an arrogant nation, they'll resent us. I think one way for us to end up being viewed as the ugly American is for us to go around the world saying, we do it this way, so should you.
Well, that's an excellent point. I don't think you can argue with that. Mr. President, is the idea to just build a new country that we like better?
We will tear down the apparatus of terror, and we will help you to build a new Iraq that is prosperous and free. I don't think our troops ought to be used for what's called nation building.
Well, that's fair enough, Governor.
That's an excerpt from The Daily Show. My guest is Ben Carlin, who is an executive producer and former head writer of the show. So Ben, do you remember how the sketch was written and what the process was like of finding the juxtaposed footage of the president?
Yeah. I mean, again, most things start with kind of just a concept or an idea. And this was kind of born out of this idea that everyone is saying so-and-so is a flip-flopper or this person is not consistent. And that's a label that people always tried, especially in last couple elections that people put on. That was a very strong tactic that Republicans used against Democrats. And we always, you know, believed that you are it's very difficult to be 100% consistent all the time, especially when cameras are always going to be on you. You're always going to be caught one way or the other. And we felt very strongly that Bush had kind of gotten this relatively free ride on this whole idea that he himself hadn't changed positions pretty radically on several things. So the idea then becomes to find the best examples to animate that. The challenge there more than anything is to try to make them funny. You know, before you want to make a point, but you got to really be very careful not to kind of dip into being super didactic.
Now, you've said that there are things in which where you think that the straight press has given a free ride to people in the administration or in Congress. How do you see the role of The Daily Show as a kind of adjunct to the press?
By definition, we exist as a reaction to the press in terms of commenting off of what they are doing or what they're not doing. But as far as a defined role, we really try not to get into that too much, only because of the desire and the need to just produce something funny every day, and the kind of what it means or what are we doing exactly doesn't really come into it like that philosophically, I would have to say. When you study it or not study it, but when you look back and say, oh, this was this or this was that, then you kind of can say, oh, well, we were actually being a commentator in the same way that an editorial cartoon would be a comment on the day's news. But I don't think we necessarily ever start a meeting by saying, okay, well, here's what the press is doing, here's what they're not doing, let's do this. That just can't enter into our process, just mainly because of efficiency. It just wouldn't work to add that added level of mission.
Ben Carlin is the former executive producer of The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. More fake news coming up after a break. This is Fresh Air. Before we get back to fake news, how about some recognition for outstanding coverage of the real news? Actually, it's not just recognition we're looking for. It's cash, because this is a fundraiser, and we really need your support to bring you the news and interview programs you rely on. And remember, even fake newsmen need to hear the real news. On today's show, we're paying tribute to fake news. Rob Corddry was a reporter on The Daily Show for 4 years before leaving last August. His younger brother, Nate, was on the show for about 10 months. They joined us together earlier this year. This is an excerpt of my conversation with Rob Corddry. Rob, would you describe the type of character you typically played as a correspondent on The Daily Show?
Well, it's interesting because characters on The Daily Show are largely audience-defined. When Ed Helms and I first started on The Daily Show, we just imitated Stephen Colbert for a year or two. I guess the audience would pick up certain nuances in our performance, and they started calling me sort of a fratish boor, and the writers started writing me that way. But I always liked to play it as we're all stupid. That's the secret to playing a Daily Show correspondent, is that you're dumb. But my character had the advantage of knowing he was dumb and didn't care.
And is that something that you figured out after you started doing it, like through the kind of feedback you were getting? Is that a direction you consciously headed in?
It's a lot easier to interview these people if you have this exaggerated, unearned confidence, especially when you know that you're dumb and you still think you're better than they are.
Well, you've interviewed a lot of people where it's hard to tell, like, what did they know in advance, particularly earlier in your appearances on The Daily Show before it became quite the phenomenon that it did. Did they know what was going on? Were they in on the joke? Did they know there was going to be a joke?
When I first started, there were researchers and associate producers who had booked the interviews there who would still say, we're with Comedy Central's news program. That is no longer possible. So I would start every interview by saying, look, you know the show, you know we're a comedy show, but I'm really going to ask you about, you know, your opinions or your passions, whatever you're here for. I want you to speak about it seriously. If I tell you the sky is green, please correct me and say the sky is blue. Don't try and follow my logic, because we're looking for straight answers. And unfortunately, I'm the jackass here. And a lot of times people would try and be funny, and we'd have to sort of steer them away from that. And even at times we'd have to say, look, I think you're a very funny guy, but none of this is going to make it on the air. Please just answer my question. Why do you hate gays? You know, or something like that.
So what are some of the responses that surprised you the most?
Oh, God. I had one guy, well, speaking of hating gays, I was speaking to probably the most homophobic person I've ever met in my life. But he told me that he worked for some family council in Philadelphia, and he said he loved gay people, and not only that, he, if they were drowning, put him in a sea of gay people, and he would breathe life into their mouths.
Oh, my God.
And we murdered this guy. We murdered him. And he called me up the next day and asked me out to lunch. He loved the piece so much.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, in addition to your interviews, of course, you did a lot of, like, stand-up reports where you'd, like, you know, talk with Jon Stewart and, you know, report on something. In fact, I want to play one. And this is one that you did shortly after President Bush announced that there would be some kind of investigation into charges, you know, allegations that there was price fixing and other problems in the oil industry. Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
I don't remember it.
Well, a profound
I spent most of my time there drunk. I am a functional alcoholic, barely.
Okay, well, this is very funny, so let's hear it.
For more on Bush's aggressive new stance against the oil companies, we turn to our senior petroleum analyst, Rob Corddry. Rob, the President of the United States didn't just talk tough today, Rob. The President didn't just talk tough. He also announced that he was taking this initiative. Take a look.
I'm also directing the Department of Justice to work with the FTC and the Energy Department to conduct inquiries into illegal manipulation or cheating related to the current gasoline prices.
He announced a query into the inner workings of the oil industry, a probe, if you will. Tell us, Rob, what will this investigation entail?
Well, for certain, it will be a long, arduous process. John, here's my guess as to how it might proceed. Now, this is the Oval Office right here. The President plans to leave it. walk down this hallway to the vice president's office.
Now, let me ask you a question, Rob. What are those black markings, if I may, what do those black X's represent?
Oh, those are the oil executives who maintain a 24-hour presence in Cheney's office. Anyway, John, the president will then begin the probe by saying to the oil executives, "Hey, Dave. Lee, how you doing? Good to see you, Jimbo. You guys been a price fixin'?" And if the answer is yes, the president will take the appropriate action.
Which would be
classified.
That was Rob Corddry with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. Rob, did you start watching the news differently after you started doing The Daily Show?
Oh, yeah. You can't help but watch the news differently. And you know, in the obvious way, just with that Daily Show sort of slant.
Which is in part looking at how news reporters and anchors carry themselves on TV?
That's my favorite part about The Daily Show is making fun of the news people themselves and the trappings of a news organization. You know, that was my right down to the chyrons or the news alerts. You know, I mean, that's some of my favorite most satirizable, I just made that word up, aspects of the news.
Rob Corddry was a reporter on The Daily Show for 4 years. Our tribute to fake news continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, our tribute to fake news continues. We'll hear from Stephen Colbert and from The Daily Show's senior black correspondent, Larry Wilmore. And I'll explain why we're not hearing from Jon Stewart.
Support for NPR comes from MGM, presenting Lars and the Real Girl, a heartfelt comedy starring Ryan Gosling, now playing in select cities, starts Friday everywhere. From NCB, a progressive financial institution serving the nation's cooperative enterprises. Learn more about NCB and other cooperatives at go.coop. And from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Wes Anderson's The Darjeeling Limited, about three brothers, 11 suitcases, and a laminating machine, now in select theaters.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're saluting some of America's top fake newsmen, so I'm sure you're wondering, how come we're not featuring an interview with Jon Stewart? Well, I interviewed Jon Stewart in 2000, before I started seriously watching The Daily Show, and I didn't quite get the show or Stewart, So the interview didn't go that well. Here's what I mean.
Jon Stewart, I first heard about you when you signed for the MTV show, The Jon Stewart Show.
First of all, thank you for calling me Jon Stewart. I think that's very nice to use my whole name, Terry Gross.
Oh, yes. All right. Okay.
You know what's nice about this, Terry?
What's nice about this?
You don't find me amusing in the slightest.
No, I do. No, why do you think? See, wait. I'm going to stop you right here. First of all, wait. Okay, so I blew it in that 2000 interview, but I'm really hoping to get a second chance. We'd so much like to have Jon Stewart back on the show when he has some time, which we realize he never does. Now let's continue with our tribute to some of America's top fake newsmen. When The Daily Show deals with the thorny issues of race, they call on their senior black correspondent, Larry Wilmore. I spoke with him earlier this year. So how do you look for the right stories to cover for The Daily Show?
You know what? It's so amazing how stories just kind of fall out of the air, you know. As you're thinking of... It's almost really hard to answer that because... You just look at something that happens and then just think about it and come up with a point of view on it. Like, for instance, DJ thought it would be a good idea to do something in Black History Month, so I just thought of something for Black History Month. You know, the fact that I wasn't that crazy about it, I thought would be a funny take, you know, that I was kind of bored with it, you know, but he just thought it would be a good idea to do something in Black History Month, where, on the other hand, I thought it would be a good idea to do something on Martin Luther King's birthday. So that it was just that simple, you know. And even before Barack Obama announced he would, when he announced he was going to make his decision to run in Springfield, like a month before he did, I thought it would be a good idea to do a piece on that. So we had planned a month in advance to do something on Obama's announcement. And then some things just pop up at the last second, like when Michael Richards did that whole thing in the comedy club. I mean, that stuff that's like manna from heaven. It just falls in your lap, you know.
Okay, so this is an excerpt of Larry Wilmore's take on Black History Month. So let's hear it, and then we'll talk about it.
As you know, February is Black History Month. Here to offer his insight, Daily Show senior black historian, Larry Wilmore. Larry, thanks for joining us.
Okay, first of all, John, relax. It's not Black History Month yet. We all have about 45 minutes to blow off some steam before we bow our heads in solemn reverence for Harriet Tubman and the Tuskegee Airmen.
Larry, I don't think you should undersell contributions of the Underground Railroad and black pilots in World War II. I think it's obviously worth taking time to commemorate these achievements.
Don't let me stop you.
Larry, I feel stupid. Don't you feel that Black History Month serves a purpose?
Yes, the purpose of making up for centuries of oppression with 28 days of trivia. You know, I'd rather we got casinos.
Larry, it's not... I'm perhaps not in a great position here, but I don't think it's trivia. I think it's important.
Really? Okay. Name the important stuff.
Well, like you were saying, Harriet Tubman.
All right.
And the Tuskegee Airmen.
Okay.
And the fella that invented the peanut.
Oh, okay.
And the heart operation.
Right,
man.
Right. Okay. All right, now we're at February 5th, okay? By the 8th, we'll be down to the Wayans brothers. And not even the famous ones. Zeppo.
Larry, what are you suggesting that we do?
John, let's be honest. Black History Month is a drag, okay? White people have to pretend to care about black people. Black people have to pretend to care about history. It's a lose-lose.
That's really funny. That's Larry Wilmore from The Daily Show. So why did you want to do something on Black History Month and do something that put it in such a skeptical light?
You know, it's, I think, part of this kind of character that I've come up with, looking for equality in different ways, you know, like wanting to be ignored or wanting to be dismissed like the way other groups are in the same way. And maybe there's a little too much reverence for some of these things like Black History. I thought it was might be a good satirical jumping off point. Plus, every black comedian I've ever seen talk about black history is always mad at the fact that it doesn't get enough attention. You know, it's always, how come there are only 28 days in February and it's Black History Month? You know, and jokes like that. So I thought it would be funny to take the opposite tack. Like, 28 days is way too long, you know. We could accomplish this, you know, in a PBS special, ladies and gentlemen, you know.
Do people often take you the wrong way and think that, like, you're really putting down the contributions of African Americans in American history?
I haven't heard that from anyone. Most people find it kind of a relief, you know. I think it's hard for people to be so reverent about stuff all the time. You know, you have to have a kind of a light approach to something sometimes, you know. But luckily for me, black people don't watch The Daily Show. So, I mean, you know. So I'm in the clear when it comes to that, you know. Whew.
Do you think that's true?
No, of course not. You know, some people do, but not in the same numbers. I go to the same barbershop I've gone to for years, and no one in there knows that I'm on The Daily Show. It's hilarious, you know. Like, I've told my barber, and he's like, oh, okay, what show is that? Now, what is it on? Now, what, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, it's The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Who's this guy? It's like, you can't win. But, you know, if you say, yeah, I was on The Steve Harvey Show, you was on The Steve Harvey Show, you know, or something like that, you know. It's pretty amazing.
How'd you come up with your character? I mean, like, on The Daily Show, you dress in, you know, very conservatively in a suit and tie.
Right.
I know it's supposed to be a news show. But
right.
Did you create a persona for yourself?
Well, not quite. There were some ideas to make me maybe a black conservative, but I didn't want to be pigeonholed. Like, I didn't want to just take the opposite point of view of something or that sort of thing. And I didn't want to be liberal or conservative and take divisive stances that would be like what I call cheerleader comedy, you know, where you're just cheerleading for one side or the other. So it's, woo, yeah, I agree with you. I thought it would be more fun to be contrary, you know, and just, you know, it's closer to my natural sense of humor, the contrariness, you know. So whatever point you're going to take, I'm not going to take the opposite point. I'll just be contrary to you, you know. And it's a very frustrating point of view because you're not sure where this person really stands. And the ability to argue either side of the issue with as much passion, too, can frustrate people. And I think it's a fun place to do comedy from, you know. Like, now, I can both defend the N-word and I can attack it at the same time with the same amount of passion. And so you're like, well, where is he coming from? Where does he stand, you know?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Larry Wilmore, who's known on The Daily Show as the senior black correspondent. He created the Bernie Mac Show and wrote for In Living Color. You may have seen him as the Diversity Day training guy on the Diversity Day episode of The Office. What are some of the TV shows you grew up with?
Wow. But I really was a kid of television. I used to have the TV Guide memorized as a kid. You know? I could tell you what night everything was on, you know. Some of the early shows I remember, the Flip Wilson Show was one of the earliest comic influences on me. That and Get Smart. In fact, I just bought the DVDs to Get Smart, and my kids watch it all the time. One, because it was so satirical, and the other because I just thought Flip was so funny. And it was the first time I saw, you know, a black man with a TV show that was his own, you know. And I mean, in those days, that was unheard of. I think Diane Carroll was the only other black person to have her own show as the lead. I mean, Bill Cosby was on I Spy, but that was a little different, you know. Here it was Flip Wilson's show, and he was just so funny to me. And that was my first big influence. And later on, I was influenced by a lot of things like All in the Family, Sanford and Son, you know, and stand-up comics like Steve Martin, Pryor. And I was always a fan of the old comedy. I'm a big, huge fan of the Marx Brothers even to this day, and Keaton and Benny and all those people. So, but TV, I watched everything on TV back then. I became a news junkie early on, too. My grandmother, when she visited us when I was a kid, would watch the news every night, and I would sit there. You know, you just want to spend time with your grandmother, but I would watch the news with her, and I became a news junkie pretty early on. Even back in those days, I can remember watching Walter Cronkite, you know. And then I was very lucky to meet Walter Cronkite years later. And as a kid, I had always wanted to be an astronaut, you know, and it was at the Peabody Awards. Walter Cronkite actually gave me the Peabody, and boy, it was a huge honor. I mean, he was such a big icon to me, and I thought, you know, I never thought I'd hear Walter Cronkite say my name, you know. you know, my wildest dreams was like, astronaut Larry Wilmore was shot to the moon yesterday, you know. And I thought, you know, if I was lucky, it was like, Larry Wilmore was arrested yesterday. You know, I mean, that would be the only way I'd hear, you know. I said, or maybe be, former astronaut Larry Wilmore was arrested yesterday. You know? And I actually made Walter Cronkite laugh. And I thought, I'm done with showbiz. I made Walter Cronkite laugh. And he shook my hand and said that was really funny and everything. And it was great. So that was a really nice closing of that circle.
Well, now you're a fake newsman.
I know. And I didn't know at the time I'd actually be on The Daily Show. And it's funny because that night I was talking to Ted Koppel and Dan Rather. And, you know, these guys are huge, you know, never thinking that one day I'd be mocking what it is that they do.
Well, but there really is news on the show. You know?
Yeah, right.
So did being a news junkie come in handy for The Daily Show?
Absolutely. And I think my wife always makes fun of me, or derides maybe the better word, that I, you know, because newspapers are always on the floor and that kind of stuff, because I read the New York Times, LA Times, sometimes Wall Street Journal, you know, and I'll read a lot online too. And, you know, to her, it's just trash. You know, why is it in the room, you know? But I just like knowing what's going on out there, and also what are the different points of view in it, too. You know, I would always watch different news, too, BBC News. Or I love it when I'm overseas and I get to see their local news and see what people are talking about, you know. And I just like to know what's going on. I don't know what that is, you know, but it definitely comes in handy, because then when you're doing The Daily Show, you just, at your fingertips, you have a lot of recall, you know, for something you may have read like a week ago that was some little article about something, you know. And you go, oh, you know what? There was this guy. He said something about blah, 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 you know. Oh, yeah, let's look that up. We'll look it up. Okay, yeah, let's do something on that, you know. So it can come in handy for that.
Larry Wilmore is The Daily Show's senior black correspondent. I spoke with him last June. Coming up, Stephen Colbert. This is Fresh Air. We're saluting some of America's top fake newsmen. Last week, Stephen Colbert made his third appearance on our show, the occasion being his new book, I Am America and So Can You. Now, I think he sent a secret message in the interview. This was right after I'd asked him if he'd gone through a period of rebellion as a young man.
I didn't really feel like I needed to rebel that much. I had a teenage rebellion, like I smoked dope and didn't do my homework, but nothing too dramatic.
Gee, I think you can't run for president or be on the Supreme Court, having just said that.
Oh, can't I? I will make sure you eat those words someday, young lady.
Those words are crunchier than I thought they'd be. Here's what happened a few days after my interview when Stephen Colbert stopped by The Daily Show.
Are you planning a run for president of the United States?
Whoa! I'm glad you asked, John. Because tonight, I, Stephen Colbert, am officially announcing that I have decided to officially consider whether or not I will announce that I am running for president of the United States.
Well, Colbert has announced his plans to run for the presidency as a favorite son on the South Carolina ballot. Here's an excerpt of the interview I recorded with him earlier this month about the Colbert Report. How has your relationship to your alter ego changed in the past couple of years now that, like, you've done the show, you know, a lot? You know, like when you were starting it, you had to, like, figure out who that character was and flesh him out. But now you've lived that character.
When we first started it, it was, well, you know, it's an amplification of the character I did on The Daily Show, who even then was a, you know, as I said, a well-intentioned, poorly informed, high-status idiot. And then we said, well, let's pick some specific models. So we picked guys like Bill O'Reilly or Anderson Cooper for his slickness or Sean Hannity for his just bullet-headed incuriosity. And we thought, okay, well, I'll be kind of tied to these guys. And obviously O'Reilly is the greatest. He's the king, so he's the clearest figure for any of that. And but then as the show's progressed, we've done things like the green screen challenge, or we've done trying to get a Hungarian bridge named after me, or challenging Sean Penn to a metaphor off, or Willie Nelson to an ice cream off. And those things really aren't political. They're really not – they're not something O'Reilly would necessarily do. And so I've found that at the base of it is still that character from The Daily Show who is well-intentioned, poorly informed, high-status idiot that I can apply to other issues.
You know, we were talking about O'Reilly and how he started off as one of your role models for your character. I just want to play a brief clip of when you were on O'Reilly's show and then he was on your show.
I better like this clip, Terry, or I will cut off your mic. Are you clear? This is your show, but I know a lot of people in broadcasting. All right, watch it.
All right, so this is an excerpt of O'Reilly on the Colbert Report.
Please welcome Papa Bear Bill O'Reilly. Bill! Welcome, sir.
Thank you. You hear that booing?
No, that's not. That's booing? Not booing. That's the bear caller going. They're going, boo, Papa Bear.
No.
No, that's ooh, Riley.
That's booing. That's Stewart. That's John Stewart in that plaid shirt.
No. I have a restraining order against John Stewart. He's not allowed in the building.
He's jealous. He's jealous of you, Colbert.
The man is a sexual predator. That's why I had to leave,
right?
Bill.
Yeah.
You have no idea what that's like.
I thought it was so amazing that you did that because you're saying about he was a sexual predator and Bill, you have no idea what that's like. And of course, everybody knew that O'Reilly had been accused of sexual harassment at that point.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I thought that was so brave to do that. I mean, so because it's like taking that kind of satire to somebody's face. Was it hard to actually do that in the room with him to his face?
The entire interview was hard. I was expecting him to come on in his persona from the show, but he immediately dropped it. We cut out almost 2 minutes of that interview because he dropped it so fully that there was really, the game was completely gone. And I didn't want to just attack a human being. I just wanted to have a tennis match with his public persona, and he dropped it. So we ended up, we had like a 7.5 minute interview, and if you time it with a stopwatch, and I know a lot of my viewers do, that was shorter than a normal interview on our show. I don't think he necessarily, you'd have to ask him, but I don't think he enjoyed facing a doppelganger.
It must have been pretty odd for him, and he was saying to you things like, you know, that's just a character. I'm really nice. I'm a really nice person. That's just an act. And then you said,
well, if you're an act, then what am I?
Yeah, I thought that was such, was that just like an improvised line?
Well, yeah, I was just startled that he would come on air and say that he doesn't mean the things he says. And I think he was joshing to deflate a moment, but it was surprising.
And I just want to say, I love it when you insult NPR.
It's my pleasure.
It's, or as you describe it in the book, Nancy Pelosi radio or Nazi Palestinian radio. And you have this great pie chart of the content of Morning Edition.
Yeah, when my character finds it offensive that NPR doesn't have to compete in the general marketplace with actual radio. As it says here, what's wrong with NPR? Just listen to Morning Edition. This is by far the least zany morning zoo ever to hit the airwaves. Instead of the get-up-and-go-larity provided by your local Scott and Tom or Ted and Zeke or Denise and Santana or Coyote Mike and the Beamer, Morning Edition presents NPR's measured barbiturate vibe. And then it has a content of Morning Zoo and content of Morning Edition, two different pie charts. And then, you know, the 57% of a Morning Zoo is sound effects or prank calls. And 39% of Morning Edition is sedition, wry essays by New Englanders, and the color light gray.
Oh, and 15% glowing descriptions of fundraising gift mug.
And the balance is just word jazz.
Stephen Colbert, thank you so much. It's really been great to talk with you.
Thanks for having me back.
Stephen Colbert recorded earlier this month. His new book is called I Am America and So Can You. This is Fresh Air. Okay, time to get back to the barbiturate vibe and the glowing descriptions of the fundraising gift mugs. But Colbert's satiric barbs ring out with a greater truth, and I don't mean truthiness. We honestly need your support in order to bring you the real news and the long-form interviews you tune in for. Thank you so much. The new film Rendition takes its name from the CIA practice of transporting terrorist suspects to secret countries that aren't bound by anti-torture laws. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal as a CIA analyst and Reese Witherspoon as the wife of a vanished Egyptian man. The director is Gavin Hood, whose film Tsotsi won an Academy Award last year. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The email from New Line Cinema arrived less than an hour after the Supreme Court handed down its decision not to hear the extraordinary rendition case of Khaled El-Masri. Hey, they said, it's just like our movie. El-Masri was a Lebanese-born German who accused the CIA of kidnapping him in 2003 and flying him to Afghanistan for interrogation and torture. Rendition recounts the same Kafkaesque nightmare, but as a sentimental, melodramatic cliffhanger with no Supreme Court to rain on the parade. The movie centers on a clean-cut, Egyptian-born U.S. resident married to Isabella, a pregnant blonde American with gumption, played by Reese Witherspoon. Really, how can someone married to her be a terrorist? But the CIA traces a suspicious call to his cell phone. And so, after a suicide bomb blast in the Middle East kills an American operative, Anwar el-Abrahimi, played by Omar Mitwali, gets snatched at the airport. Following a relatively civil interrogation in the U.S., a rendition decision comes down from the CIA's Director of Indifference to Life. Sorry, I didn't get her exact title, but she's impersonated by Meryl Streep in a performance that drifts into low camp. Anwar will be shipped to a hellhole dungeon in an unnamed country for what you might call the full Dante, as in Ninth Circle. Now, when it comes to terrorism, context is everything. Suspects tortured on TV's 24 have clear knowledge of missiles with nuclear warheads whizzing toward L.A. at this very second. And the high-priced civil liberties lawyers who descend on the scene within the hour have been hired by terrorists taking cunning advantage of our Bill of Rights. On the other hand, people tortured in lefty dramas like The Road to Guantanamo were arrested by mistake, and no impoverished civil liberties lawyer can get anywhere near them for years. Rendition is the Hollywood Road to Guantanamo. We're meant to watch the beatings, waterboardings, and electric shockings of the naked Anwar and feel sick to our souls. On separate continents, Jake Gyllenhaal and Peter Sarsgaard grapple with the issue of extraordinary rendition, which at the time the movie set is not well publicized. Gyllenhaal plays Douglas Freeman, a green CIA analyst who takes over as advisor to Anwar's interrogation when a colleague is blown up. Sarsgaard is Alan Smith, Isabella's ex-boyfriend, who works for a powerful senator played by Alan Arkin. Here are the moral dilemmas. Will Alan convince his cautious boss to expose the practice before Congress and the American people? Will Douglas, tortured by conscience, do more than drink himself into a stupor at the end of the day? Here he is with Egal Nayor as the torturer with no doubts.
If you don't have the stomach for this, then you should ask to be reassigned. Douglas, I can't help you.
We have a saying, too. Do you know Shakespeare?
Of course, I know Shakespeare.
I fear you speak upon the rack, where men enforced do speak anything. Saeed, in all the years you've been doing this, how often can you say that we've produced truly legitimate intelligence? Once? Twice? 10 times? Just give me a statistic. Give me a number. Give me a pie chart. I love pie charts. Anything. Anything that outweighs the fact that if you torture one person, you create 10, 100, 1,000 new enemies.
Having that Shakespeare quote handy. But Gyllenhaal sells it. He's a reticent actor. He doesn't take many chances. But he builds that limitation into the character. His immobility reeks of fear and self-disgust. So it's a stirring moment when he leads with his outrage. It's too bad rendition is so clunky and ham-handed. Speeches like that start to come thick and fast, and the director, Gavin Hood, never finds a rhythm for all the cross-cutting. It's the cast that pulls you in. Witherspoon is touching as she waddles around knocking on doors and staring down officials with her pleading blue eyes. And Sarsgaard is remarkably believable as an ambitious politico. Every word he utters seems calculated, the result of a quick cost-benefit analysis, and you never know which way he'll go because his thoughts are so shrouded. Rendition isn't, in the end, about torture as much as whistleblowing. In its preachy but compelling way, it asks whether an individual's conscience can triumph over careerism and willed moral blindness. Even 24's Jack Bauer can relate to that.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
1, 2, 3, 4.
On the next Fresh Air, Dave Grohl. He's the frontman of the band The Foo Fighters and was the drummer in Nirvana when Kurt Cobain died. The Foo Fighters have a new CD called Echoes, Silence, Patience, and Grace. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.